from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. After all the chest-thumping of the fall, the apocalyptic threats and warnings, and government shutdown over the federal budget, this time it's been different. Republican Congressman Paul Ryan of Wisconsin and Senator Patty Murray, Democrat of Washington State, have been quietly hammering out a budget deal that would avoid a government shutdown in January and pull back on the much-debated sequester. There are still hot buttons out there on military spending, unemployment benefits, and more, but there also just might be a deal that will pass. This hour, On Point, the outline of a deal on the federal budget. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Where would you cut or restore, fight, compromise? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we'll hear a portion of President Obama's speech at Nelson Mandela's memorial ceremony today in Johannesburg, South Africa. Joining me first today from Washington is Jake Sherman, congressional reporter for Politico. Jake, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
A little snow in Washington and the federal government is shut down, I understand.
You guys wouldn't blink at this in Boston or New England, but yeah, we tend to overreact here when there's a little dusting.
All right, well, stay safe in that few inches. So here we've got Patty Murray and we've got Paul Ryan, respectively, chairman of House committees in the Senate and House of Representatives. And what do we know about what they have coming in? And some of our listeners, by the time they hear this, it may be out there. What do they have up on the table, up on the rails, Jake?
The basic outlines of this agreement are as follows. It's the agreement that's being hammered out between Ryan and Murray, which we expect and expected in the last 12 hours, we expected to hear it today. It's never clear when these things come together, but it sets overall spending levels for the next 2 years. Right now, the government is slated to spend $967 billion next year. This agreement would raise that equally split between defense and non-defense spending, and it would set a level for 2014 and 2015, but simultaneously, it also basically swaps out the sequester cuts. The sequester is slated to really hit the military in 2014, and this deal would kind of peel back at that and replace those cuts with cuts in other areas of the federal budget, and also in part replace the replace it with some revenue, not new tax increases or loophole closures, but basically increasing fees on things like airline tickets, which, a lot of things that happen in Washington, most Americans don't feel or might not notice or, might mm-hmm. fly under the radar. But if you're paying a little bit more in TSA, Transportation Security Administration fees, it's going to feel like you're paying more for your airline ticket. So that's an important component to keep in mind.
Now, they need something here because there's still, I suppose, a potential shutdown looming January 15th, is it, if they don't have some kind of deal?
Even if they do have it, the government could still shut down. I mean, the basic premise here is that these spending levels would make it easier to cull together what we call in Washington an omnibus spending bill, which would you basically roll all of the 14 appropriation bills into one legislative package and then fund the government at that. But what makes this deal, what makes a government shutdown less likely with this deal is that the House and Senate aren't arguing over the top line spending levels. There's a level there they've agreed to, and that makes it easier to kind of come together and get an agreement. But there's still a lot of work to be done once this deal is done. The Appropriations Committees, which in the House is led by Hal Rogers of Kentucky and in the Senate's led by Barbara Mikulski of Maryland, they still have to hash out individual appropriation bills, which sometimes are basically they fund each individual agency of the government. So they have to work on those over the next month to try to get that legislative vehicle going.
So if they go with this, the uniform sequester, as we've known it, those across the board, rigid cuts, that would be broken. There would be a new deal here. I mean, it would be modified in a way that would no longer be that universal level of cuts. I guess part of the way that they got up and on the rails here is by taking entitlements off the table, right? That was the beginning move in this conversation between Patty Murray and Paul Ryan.
Taking entitlements off the table and tax increases off the table, kind of the not hobby horse, but one of the most important, one of the two most important elements of to both parties, or things that they've pushed for in previous negotiations. So that definitely did smooth the path in a way to a deal. Once you decide you're not going to talk about the things that divide the two parties, it certainly makes everything easier.
That also means people are going to look at this and say, this is not the serious heavy lifting that needs to be done here. What about who's giving what in this? What's going to be hard for Democrats to swallow? What might be hard for Republicans to swallow here, Jim?
Well, start with Democrats. I mean, Democrats are not getting an extension of emergency unemployment benefits.
If this goes through, and all this, of course, not fully determined, not voted on yet, but that's what they're apparently planning to offer.
What's that? They're not a plan. That is not going to be in the deal. Emergency jobless benefits. So that was probably going to be left on the side. Republicans don't want to extend those. Yep. Now that doesn't mean people with jobless benefits will see them all disappear. A lot of jobless benefits are done at the state level, and then as part of, I believe, one of the stimulus packages in the last couple of years, the president and Congress worked out a deal to extend jobless benefits past the 27 weeks to, I think, 48 weeks. Now, those are going to be left on the side. Republicans are going to be not terribly pleased that the overall spending is going to be raised from $967 billion to nearly $1 trillion. Also, Republicans have been obsessed with this idea of solving big problems, solving the Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, tax reform, solving these big problems that are drivers of the debt. They're not doing that here at all in any way, shape, or form. This is, as Democrats have talked about, this is a very unimpressive deal, and Republicans say that as well. Very narrow and very tailored.
Why is that emerging here? Were Republicans just not ready to get back into full battle mode after the heat that they took over the shutdown?
I think that's exactly right. I don't think Republicans are terribly interested in a budget battle again. If it weren't for the health care law and the bumpy rollout of the website and other elements of Obama's health care law, Republicans would really be in a bad shape. Their numbers were driven to new lows after the government shutdown, and they were kind of rescued politically by the president's botched rollout of the health care program, law. So I don't think they're eager to get back in the trenches and fight a war that they're going to lose. They know they're not. Most Republicans who are realistic and telling the truth understand that they're not going to defund the president's health care law, and it's not worth shutting the government and driving their numbers to new lows, especially in an election year.
Now, we've also got cuts to federal pensions potentially in here. Is that correct?
That's right. They are building off of a proposal in President Barack Obama's budget to roll back some federal benefits. It's not entirely clear how much money is going to come from that. Republicans wanted $120 billion. Democrats were more in the $20 billion range. But that was one of the big elements of this emerging agreement.
What is it that suddenly makes pensions fair again? We saw it in Detroit. We saw it in Illinois. We've seen it other places. And now this would be federal pensions. Is that the new ethos? Pensions are fair game for cuts?
I think that the kind of the broader point here is that since Republicans took the House in January of 2011, they've cut trillions, along with President Obama and Senate Democrats, trillions of dollars from federal budgets. So there's only so many places you can cut from at this point. And I think that's the kind of the reality that a lot of lawmakers who are involved in these talks are facing, that they don't have a lot of places they could cut from, and they have to find every corner of the budget and shave it off as much as they can.
So how's this happening procedurally? Are they going to roll this out and then just wait and see how each chamber, House and Senate, respond? Or do they have deals with the leadership in advance? Can they bring the Tea Party crowd on the Republican side? Can they bring Democrats on, who have been making very loud noise saying they do not want to see the long-term unemployment benefits cut?
Right. I mean, the John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, has said he wants to be out of session on Friday, so 2 or 3 days from now. That's tough. That means that the House would probably have this deal would need to be rolled out today and get a vote on Friday. The way John Boehner and his allies see it is that this package will go through the House for several reasons. They have leadership, which is a kind of a wide group of members who are loyal to Boehner and loyal to institutionalists and yep. more moderate Republicans who will vote for this package. Then there's the armed services folks who don't want to see the cuts to the military. Then there are the appropriators, the budget writers who basically are charged with funding the government, who want to return to some normalcy. Mm-hmm. The nation has been operating on stopgap budgets for many years. This would avoid that once again. So they think they have a coalition that could help us get through, but there's no question this is going to be a tough vote for House Republicans across the board.
And what about Nancy Pelosi and her Democrats, or Democrats in the Senate, for that matter, looking at those unemployment benefit cuts?
I think that Democrats are obviously upset for several reasons, the jobless benefits and things of that nature. But at the end of the day, if President Barack Obama blesses this deal, which we haven't seen yet, he's obviously in Africa along with several members of Congress, history would show that they are likely to go along. It's not certain, but history would show that.
And Patty Murray and Paul Ryan, do they have the standing, the clout to come out of this, or does this turn into a problem for them?
I think Paul Ryan is somebody that gets a lot of respect in the House of Representatives, and if his prints are on something, a lot of people think it's good. they think he's a smart guy. They think he's an honest broker. So I think that helps House Republicans. And in the Senate, Patty Murray definitely has the approval of Harry Reid, the Senate Democratic leader, who has deputized her, in a sense, to do these negotiations. So I don't think the Senate's going to be as heavy of a lift. I think a lot of people want to avoid a shutdown. The House will be tricky, but all signs at this point point to this thing getting through the chamber if House Democrats come along.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a budget deal in the making, apparently, in Washington. Sequester, shutdown, long-term employment benefits, all in the balance there. Democrat Patty Murray and Republican Paul Ryan on the trail of an agreement. We may know more very soon. By the time you hear us, this may be out. But action this week, if it's supposed to happen before the House, John Boehner says, will adjourn on Friday. Jake Sherman is with us, covers Congress for Politico, and right in the middle of all of this. Two more great observers of what's going on here as well right now. With us from Washington, Heather Boucher, Executive Director, Chief Economist at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth at the Center for American Progress, left-leaning think tank there. Heather Boucher, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
And with us from Arlington, Virginia, is Douglas Holtz Aiken, President of the American Action Forum, right-leaning economic policy think tank from 03 to 05. He was director of the Congressional Budget Office from 2001 to 2, chief economist of the President's Council of Economic Advisors under George W. Bush. Douglas Holtz Aiken, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Heather, first to you. What do you think of this apparent deal in the making?
Well, on the one hand, we certainly need to get to a deal. We don't want to go through another shutdown like we experienced a few months ago. So that certainly is the number one priority for Congress right now. But as an economist, I have to tell you, I'm a little frustrated that we're not getting to the kind of deal we need that's really going to grow the economy and strengthen American families. I'm going to be one of those economists who's worried about the fact that it appears that extending unemployment benefits is not a part of the package. And, you know, while, again, it's really great to get to a deal, it'd be good to see the kind of deal that targeted spending a little bit more in a more focused way on long-term growth, and where we weren't so focused on cutting spending, but really focused on giving the economy the kind of continued boost it needs so that we can get back on track. You know, it remains the case that the share of Americans with a job is just a few tenths of a percentage point higher than it was in the deepest, darkest days of the Great Recession. That's about 5 years out now.
Even with the lower unemployment rate, you're saying, because of participation rates?
Yes, even with the unemployment rate has dropped, but and we've seen job creation. We added 200,000 jobs last month, but because of the growth of the labor force and because so many people had been forced to drop out of the labor force because they simply couldn't find work, the share of people with a job remains almost as bad as it was in the deepest, darkest days. So that's an ongoing problem. Our economic problems in terms of the labor market have not been solved.
So you want more spending in part to help address that, but this delivers more spending, right? It goes from, if delivered as we expect, from $967 billion to a trillion. That's a bump.
That's why, some deal better than no deal, bump better than no bump. But I think we need to continually keep our eyes focused on the fact that for millions of American families, this is not yet the kind of recovery that they need. And the budget is not the end-all be-all in terms of getting us there, but it certainly is an important piece of the puzzle and the one piece of the puzzle that Congress really has a lot of control over.
Douglas Holtz-Aiken, what do you see of what apparently is emerging from these Patty Murray, Paul Ryan talks?
I think there's good news on both the policy and the political front. On policy, if we get the kind of deal that Jake described, it would shift us from bad policy. For example, under the planned sequester, we'd see a $19 billion cut in defense spending in January, and then we'd turn around and spend an additional $23 billion over the next 2 years. So we would take an elaborate U-turn to get right back where we started. There's no virtue to that. It hurts readiness. It hurts our capability. And it's just being driven by budget numbers. So you get rid of bad policy, you replace it with better policy, and you shift the focus from the annual spending on defense and non-defense activities, the basic research, education that have been cut under the sequester, and instead move it to the part of the budget where we have our big problems, which are in the so-called mandatory spending programs. Now, I'll be the first one to admit, as Heather and Jacob pointed out, this is not a big deal. This is numerically small. It misses the large tax and entitlement issues that have to be dealt with eventually. But it's better policy than what we have, and that's good news. Politics,
yes,
we'd get a deal. And that's a big step in the right direction.
It's something we haven't seen much of lately in Congress. Jake, it's not only military spending that would go up. It's also National Institutes of Health and scientific research, which Democrats have been more supportive of.
And that's what's in it for Democrats politically. I mean, and that's kind of why they have an incentive to get this thing across the finish line is that they feel, and they'll privately say, that President Obama's hamstrung by these very small budgets, and they're hamstrung, and Congress is, their hands tied by small budgets and low-level spending. So this gets them to a point where there's more money, that the government's spending more money, and that's an important thing for them.
Douglas Holtz-Aiken, what about the long-term unemployment benefits here? We heard Rand Paul saying that if you keep those long-term benefits, you're encouraging a culture of dependency. On the other hand, there are a lot of people who are just simply out of a job, and jobs are hard to find, and it takes a long time for many people.
Unemployment benefits have always been a mixed blessing. They're a very valuable tool for people who lose a job, need some money to get them through while they search for a new job. Obviously, the recovery is abysmal at best, and so search is taking longer than anyone would like. On the other hand, there's a lot of evidence that unemployment insurance extends spells of unemployment, that when workers are out of work for a long period of time, their skills erode, and they often don't make as much when they do go back. And so there's a point at which, you know, too much unemployment insurance is a recognized bad. Unfortunately, we don't know exactly where that point is, and I think in the current circumstances, it'd be pretty tough for Republicans to take a strong stand and say, we know that these are too much. The reality, I think, is going to be that if they want to get a deal and as a result take off the table government shutdown, take off the table the political and economic harm that comes with government shutdowns, they have to take things out on both sides that they'd like to get. And this looks to be one of the casualties of getting a deal. And it's one of the reasons why no one loves a deal, that in the end, deals are the coalition of the disgruntled, and they get a little bit of what they want, but not
right.
Everything.
I want to be sure I understand what you mean. Are you suggesting that the long-term unemployment coverage may stay in this deal?
No. I think it's out, and I think it has to be out, or they don't get a deal. I mean, they may come back to it as a separate legislative initiative. We'll see. And if they did, I think many Republicans would vote for it.
Heather Boucher, do you see Democrats on the Hill going along with the cut in long-term unemployment benefits?
Well, we've seen Democrats saying that it's very important to them, but at least my understanding of the nature of the political debate is that they haven't said that it is a non-starter in terms of that it needs to be in the budget deal. But I want to push back on a couple of things that Doug said. I mean, I think that, you know, this is a political deal that, as Doug's just eloquently outlined, is being made in some way on the backs of those who can least afford it. So, you know, we've had this economic crisis that the unemployed did not cause. We've seen years of job growth that's been steady but slow and not fast enough to pull all those folks back into the labor force. We've seen millions of people unemployed for more than 6 months, a year, maybe 2 years, pounding the pavement, trying to find a job. Doug's right, skills erode. People have a hard time getting back in. We've seen a lot of evidence emerge that employers discriminate against the long-term unemployed. They're more likely to hire somebody who already has a job or who hasn't been unemployed for very long. That's a big problem, makes it even harder for folks to get back into the labor market.
But you hear Republicans effectively saying, okay, so don't let them stay out so long. Force them back in by pulling that unemployment benefit, and it'll be the hot poker in their back. They'll get back in there somehow, and it'll be painful, but they'll be better off, seems to be the kind of construction, Heather.
Right. And so basically they're saying that some magic job fairies are just going to create jobs for those people, which quite frankly has not been happening. I mean, that is a you're basically saying, hey, unemployed person, you haven't been able to find work. No problem. It's your fault for some reason. But once we strip away your benefits and take away the last shred of income you have, a job will magically appear. Now, if you can make that happen, that would be fantastic. But that's not the reality of what's been happening in the labor market. And this is not just hard for those families. It's hard on communities. It's hard on the landlord because that unemployed family is not going to be able to pay their rent. They're not going to be able to pay their mortgage. They're not going to be able to afford to go to the grocery store. They're not going to be able to afford new shoes for the kids,
yeah.
Christmas presents.
Yeah.
I mean, so this is continues to be an important economic issue. And I do think it is interesting that that is the price of getting the government in some ways not to shut down.
Yeah, a couple of prices in here, but that's a big one, getting a lot of attention. Douglas, I'll take it. I'll bring that to you. But a couple of our callers first, if I may. Green Bay, Wisconsin, Ben is calling. Hi, Ben, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
What do you think?
I was just going to build on what your guest had just said. I was under the impression that unemployment benefits are the most crucial sort of area of spending for times of recovery because that's what stabilizes demand and keeps people spending money and spurs growth because, you know, without people buying goods, there's no real reason for businesses to expand and hire people. So it seems a little contradictory to me for Republicans to be so sort of vindictive in their stance towards the unemployed and cutting their benefits.
How long do we keep emergency long-term benefits going on, Ben?
That's a tough question that needs to be discussed, but I don't think the time to cut them is yet. Personally, but I'm not, an expert on it.
All you have to do is look around to have a certain kind of expertise to see people without jobs, and it is tough. Baby needs new shoes, as Heather says. But then on the other hand, there's that deficit. Emergency's gone on for a long time now. Ben, I appreciate your call. Let me get one more here. Randy in Peoria, Illinois. Randy, you're on the air.
Yeah. Listen. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have lost my job 8 years ago in my middle 50s.
That's long term. That's a long time.
I have been a lifelong Democrat. Let me give them some advice. Stop spending around the edges everything else. Just give us jobs. I know this. If I were up there, I could do it. I have seen them go at every fringe thing. Now is the time. People are desperate for jobs. I have sold down all of my assets. I have been employed moderately. Just give us jobs.
Randy, are you saying give us long-term employment benefits or don't give us long-term unemployment benefits?
Stop it. Stop it. Stop all that stupid stuff. It's around the fringes, all of that spending. It does no good. Just provide the type of development that puts people to work. I would take any reasonable work. I'm telling you, it's not fair. If people could employ other people, I have ideas for jobs.
Just make the jobs, Randy. We got it. Douglas Holtz-Aiken, there's music for Rand Paul's ears right there. Like, enough already, just give me the job. But what about, our caller from Green Bay who says, look, isn't this the thing that's supposed to help float the economy when it's bad? What about Heather's outlook that this is the structural way that government can both, blunt the edge of the harshness of unemployment and help bring back the economy?
So, I mean, once you get past the caricatures and the hyperbole, if you look at what's actually on the table, it's long-term unemployment insurance benefits. Unemployment benefits won't be gone entirely.
Of course.
The CBO estimates that what's really at stake is about 300,000 jobs. So a month to a month and a half of jobs.
1.3 million?
The most recent estimate for this particular piece of extension is 300,000 jobs. This is not large by any macroeconomic measure. And you don't want to think of it as something that's done in isolation. Republicans are comparably frustrated at the poor economic recovery and what they view as the lack of appropriate economic policymaking out of the White House. And they've passed 40 jobs bills in the House that have gone to die in the Senate. So I think that What we're seeing are the philosophies once again in conflict on how best to meet the genuine needs of the American worker who have been ill-served by this recovery. And it's not a unemployment benefits or not question. It's a how are we going to get the economy to grow? Are we going to continue to rely on stimulus-oriented spending out of government that really has a poor track record? Or are we going to change the channel and respect the evidence that this hasn't worked and try something different?
Jake Sherman, what about you hear from Green Bay? Bring those long-term benefits on. That's what we need in this economy. You hear from Peoria right there, a one-time Democrat who just doesn't believe in it anymore, sort of ready to just peel everything back and hope that new stuff grows where all the benefits go away. Is that political opportunity for Republicans, Jake?
It is, but Republicans have failed to capitalize on most opportunities they've had in the last couple of years. John Boehner tried to pass you heard him talk about development, and I'm assuming he meant infrastructure and government programs of government spending of that nature. John Boehner tried to pass a highway bill, a big highway bill, I believe it was last year, it might have been the year before, and completely failed. So this is not a Republican majority that's been particularly adept at doing anything proactive. They've struggled at basic functions of governing, like keeping the government funded and raising the debt ceiling and passing a farm bill. So to ask, it's been a heavy lift for them to do those things. So there's no real reason to believe that they could provide for, huge development or infrastructure projects like the caller suggested. But Republicans are pretty blunt about how long-term unemployment benefits are not going to be in this package. And basically, they've told me in the last couple of days that they have absolutely no plan to move any sort of other bill that would extend emergency jobless benefits. So it seems like for the time being, those are going by the wayside.
Heather, what do you say to our one-time Democrat in central Illinois who just isn't sure that government benefits are going to help reprime the pump anymore?
Well, I think that I have a couple of reactions. First and foremost, there have been a lot of ideas on the table, and Jake just talked about some of them, that would have gotten more people back to work and that would have spurred our both short-term and long-term growth. I think back to September 2010, I believe it was September, where the president put forth the American Jobs Act, which would have added funding for, among other things, infrastructure projects, which would have directly gotten people back to work. There have been ideas on the table over the past few years to put more people back to work through national service programs and a variety of other, a long list of endeavors that we could have done that haven't been done. Massive missed opportunities. And I want to underscore something that Jake said. This Congress and the prior one have been singularly focused in many ways on thwarting recovery, not pushing it forward. Things like the debt ceiling debacle, things like shutting down the government, these have all cost our economy, both in terms of GDP, but directly in terms of job creation. So they've been sort of misfocused. So to sort of say that this one, and Doug is right in the sense that this is the unemployment benefits are only for the long-term unemployed. It is not the biggest the biggest piece of the puzzle right now, but it is an important piece. And to sort of, it is very, I think, very vindictive to sort of put all of so much of the challenges on people who can ill afford it while not focusing on the kinds of spending that would spur long-term growth.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a budget deal in the making in Washington. Sequester, shut down, long-term unemployment benefits, all in the balance. Democrat Patty Murray and Republican Paul Ryan on the trail of an agreement, and it may be rolled out, may be voted on, possibly quite soon. Short clock in Washington these days. Heather Boucher is with us from the Washington Center for Equitable Growth and the Center for American Progress. Douglas Holtz-Aiken here from the American Action Forum. Jake Sherman covers Congress for Politico. We're going to hear from Barack Obama's speech in Johannesburg today in a few minutes. All kinds of response here. Honest Debate says a compromise between gargantuan government spending and huge government spending is a waste of time, a kind of Tea Party perspective there that we may yet hear from in the House of Representatives. On the other hand, Peter writes, GOP policy ruins economy, ruins pensions. Now GOP cuts pensions and asks, see a pattern there. Dave's calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Dave, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call. Yeah. I think we're kind of skirting around the historical issue of what happens when you push people really hard like this into the oblivion of no jobs and no money. They'll fight back, Tom. This is the recipe for revolution. This is a recipe for violence. This is a recipe for people striking back. If you take my food away from my babies, I will come to your neighborhood, and I will take yours. And I think this sentiment is one where, you know, we don't have a big enough security force. Most of the veterans right now that have come back from war that are highly trained are hungry, looking for jobs. This security apparatus that we have will only last so long before the people rise up. And maybe that's what they're trying to do. Maybe they're trying to push us into getting off Facebook and getting back out into the streets.
And you're saying take away long-term unemployment benefits and the kind of supports for people who can't find a job, and you may be provoking trouble.
Yeah, rather than death by a thousand cuts, why not burn it down to the ground, and then we'll see what happens.
Dave, I mean, that's hard bar, but there's hard reality out there. Jake Sherman, do you hear Capitol Hill in touch with or afraid of that kind of sentiment? You know, does it feel on Capitol Hill like it's an abstract debate, or does it have that vividness behind it?
I think every debate on Capitol Hill is kind of abstract, frankly. I mean, people generally, I mean, listen, people are listening to their constituents, but we're in a time where the House majority is has made their calling card, I mean, their central mission, slicing it, the deficit and not spending money. So that's kind of been the singular focus. Obviously, there's a lot of talk about the healthcare law and cutting back on that, but these debates are always kind of abstract from elected members of Congress.
And what about Douglas Holtz-Eakin in the GOP, the real hard bar budget cutters who want to go after entitlement? Do you think they'll come on board for this? Are they too exhausted after the shutdown of the fall?
The GOP is far from unified. There is a group largely elected in 2010 who believe they were sent to Washington to simply say no. They do it quite effectively. And who believe that any cut is a good cut. And they are the most likely to resist moving away from the sequester because they think that that's something that's firm and any movement away from it to spend more in the near term will end up being a gimmick, or we'll spend it now and never get it back later. And that's going to be a group that the leadership's going to have to deal with. There's another very different group, notably led by Paul Ryan, that believes that our retirement and health systems need to be reformed in their own right, that they are bleeding red ink and will fall under their own financial weight, that doesn't serve the beneficiaries well, that we need to have a sustainable social safety net, and that reform of those programs is the key, not mere cuts. Cuts gets it wrong. If you cut it and you don't change it, you don't change the architecture that's giving us problems to begin with. So there's far from a unified group that wants to cut spending. There's a lot of different flavors out there. This deal, I think, is as small as it is for exactly that reason. The coalition you can get on the right and the coalition you can get on the left is only large enough if there's very little on the table, and there's not much on the table in this deal.
David in Nashville, Tennessee. David, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I must live in a different world than anyone else. Here in Sumner County in Tennessee, Sumner County has seen the largest growth in government dependence of any other county in Tennessee, and we have hiring signs in windows. Employers are advertising on billboards. They can't get people to come to work. The employers are competing directly with the federal government. Federal government's paying people to sit at home. Employers can't fill jobs. The office I work for has been understaffed for the last 3 months. But don't worry, I'm not going to resort to violence like that leftist you just had on.
David, we've got it. What do you say to that, Heather? The employers competing with the federal government, you know, people who would rather, so our caller says, have their unemployment check, then take one of those jobs.
Well, you know, I think it is exciting to see that there are some parts of the country that are seeing recovery, and I don't know much. I've been to many places in Tennessee, but I've never been to Sumner, and I don't know much about their economy right now. But if that's the kind of labor market that they're seeing, then certainly there's something good going on there. And my gut is that if there are jobs, what you see time after time, at least in the research, is that people will go out there and take them. So we don't see a lot of people staying home when there are good jobs available, jobs that they can take and develop their skills and put food on the table. Jobs almost by definition pay a lot more than what you can make from just sitting at home. So hopefully that's a good thing, and hopefully that kind of we'll start seeing more of that kind of economic evidence coming in from around the country.
I wouldn't say almost by definition when a lot of people get minimum wage and not a 40-hour week. It's not necessarily by definition anymore. Isn't that one of the problems here? Some of these jobs, you know, that our economy is producing these days are not very well paying.
Certainly, but that is for most people, that's going to be a lot more than you could get from some sort of benefit.
Yeah.
So certainly the kinds of jobs that we've seen created in this recovery have been disproportionately low-wage jobs. We've seen the bulk of the gains of the recovery going to folks in the top 1% at the very top of the income distribution. So we've seen companies coming back. We've seen the stock market go gangbusters. We haven't seen that reinvested and the creating in the kind of good jobs that we would like to see. So you're right. That is a big problem. But the point that I was trying to make is that the way that we've structured most of our social insurance system is that getting a job is going to give you a lot more benefits than any kind of government benefits will.
Charlie in Asheville, North Carolina. Charlie, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. First of all, I want to say I have tremendous respect for you and this program. Thank you.
You're so welcome.
I squeezed the last of my long-term unemployment to put myself through truck driving school. And I want to say this. I think what we're witnessing is 30 years of failed tax policy, believing that tax cuts for the so-called job creators are going to create jobs. We haven't seen that happen. It doesn't work. It's time to return to a more rational tax structure on the wealthy in this country.
Charlie, we're getting short on time, but tell us, did you get a job after that truck driver's school? Are you driving a truck these
yes.
days? Did it work out?
I am. I'm pulled over in a rest area right now, north of Charlotte, North Carolina. I'm driving 10,000 miles a month. I'm making two-thirds of what I used to make when I was a building inspector.
Wow. And what if you had not had the long-term unemployment insurance that allowed you to get that training?
Well, you know, short-term unemployment is where you're going to stay in your
field.
Yeah. Well, the building industry was still on the ropes. I needed to do something else.
Yeah. Yeah, and it takes more than 20 weeks to learn a new field, I guess. I appreciate your call, Charlie. Douglas Holtzakin, what about there's a truck-driving man who bit the bullet, went back out, makes a lot less than he used to make, but took advantage, made good use of that time. He's out 10,000 miles a month is a lot of driving, but he's not happy with the structure of the economy. He says that our tax policy has created with was favoring the job, quote-unquote, job creator upper income.
Sure. I think one of the things it points out is that there's a big difference between the temporary unemployment, which we have designed to help people who have spells of joblessness, the need for training support for people who are going to change their jobs. It's not a spell. They're going to go do something new. And then third, poverty programs for those who are genuinely out of work and handicapped in getting a job. One of the things that I think has happened with the UI program, the unemployment insurance program, is that it's sort of trying to be all things to all people. And I think Congress would be well served to think about those three different problems individually, in particular the training issues. We have a lot of folks who are very similar to the caller and a big cohort of young people who are badly damaged by this recession, who in the absence of what I think must be aggressive efforts to get them back into the labor force will simply not have a labor force attachment. That becomes a lifetime problem of poverty and detachment from the economy and social issues. And so I think that's what Congress should focus on. I think that's the structural issue of the moment.
We will be watching Washington this week to see if this carefully tailored kind of narrow deal can be the key that turns the lock on the budget right now. But clearly still a lot of big issues left sitting out there. Douglas Holtz-Aiken at the American Action Forum, thank you very much for your insights this hour, Doug.
Thank you.
Heather Boucher at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. Heather, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, Tom.
And Jake Sherman, terrific reporter for Politico covering Congress. Jake, thanks for all your time today.
Thanks so much.
In just a moment, President Obama's tribute to Nelson Mandela today in South Africa. This is On Point. Tens of thousands of South Africans and more gathered in a pouring rain at a soccer stadium in Johannesburg today, joining world leaders to honor Nelson Mandela. He died last week at 95. A roar of cheers met President Obama as he rose to speak. To the people of South Africa, people of every race and every walk of life, the world thanks you for sharing Nelson Mandela with us, he said. President Obama concluded with a call for people to honor Mandela, calling him by his clan name Madiba, with a moment of self-reflection and stopping to ask, how well have I applied his lessons in my own life?
We too must act on behalf of justice. We too must act on behalf of peace. There are too many people who happily embrace Madiba's legacy of racial reconciliation, but passionately resist even modest reforms that would challenge chronic poverty and growing inequality. There are too many leaders who claim solidarity with Madiba's struggle for freedom, but do not tolerate dissent from their own people. And there are too many of us on the sidelines, comfortable in complacency or cynicism, when our voices must be heard. The questions we face today, how to promote equality and justice, how to uphold freedom and human rights, how to end conflict and sectarian war, these things do not have easy answers. But there were no easy answers in front of that child born in World War I. Nelson Mandela reminds us that it always seems impossible until it is done. South Africa shows that is true. South Africa shows we can change, that we can choose a world defined not by our differences, but by our common hopes. We can choose a world defined not by conflict, but by peace and justice and opportunity. We will never see the likes of Nelson Mandela again. But let me say to the young people of Africa and the young people around the world, you too can make his life work your own. Over 30 years ago, while still a student, I learned of Nelson Mandela and the struggles taking place in this beautiful land, and it stirred something in me. It woke me up to my responsibilities, to others and to myself, and it set me on an improbable journey that finds me here today. And while I will always fall short of Madiba's example, he makes me want to be a better man. He speaks to what's best inside us. After this great liberator is laid to rest, and when we've returned to our cities and villages and rejoined our daily routines, let us search for his strength. Let us search for his largeness of spirit somewhere inside of ourselves. And when the night grows dark, when injustice weighs heavy on our hearts, when our best laid plans seem beyond our reach, let us think of Madiba and the words that brought him comfort within the four walls of his cell. It matters not how straight the gate, how charged the punishment, the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. What a magnificent soul it was. We will miss him deeply. May God bless the memory of Nelson Mandela. May God bless the people of South Africa.
President Obama paying tribute to Nelson Mandela, speaking to thousands of South Africans in a soccer stadium in Johannesburg today. To hear President Obama's full address and for a transcript, go to our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, James Ross, and Dean Russell, with help from Emily Alfin Johnson, Abigail Collins, and Austin Federa. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.